Welcome to Audio Notes. I'm Patrick Castillo, and I have the great pleasure of introducing you to the 2014 season's Carte Blanche Concerts, Music at Menlo's signature series of artist-curated recital programs. Each year, Music at Menlo invites a cadre of chamber music's finest recitalists and chamber musicians to design a program highlighting their particular musical interests and indulging their most audacious creative impulses. In previous seasons, the Carte Blanche series has featured such memorable concerts as Colin Carr's performance of the complete Bach cello suites, Randall Scarlatta and Gilbert Kalisch's performance of Schubert's Winterreise, the Borromeo String Quartet's complete Bartok quartet cycle, as well as marathon recital programs by pianists Alessio Bax and Stephen Prutzman, violinist Suvin Kim, cellist Lawrence Lesser, and more. This season's Carte Blanche series promises to continue the festival's tradition of unforgettable musical experiences. We have four Carte Blanche concerts lined up, beginning with the Escher String Quartet's performance of the complete quartets of Alexander von Zemlinsky on Wednesday, July 23. On Sunday, July 27, pianist Arnaldo Cohen makes his Music at Menlo debut with a program of music by Bach, Brahms, and Chopin. Violinist Yura Lee and pianist Dina Weinstein follow on Wednesday, July 30, with a dazzling program of Czech and Hungarian virtuoso works. And pianist Gilles von Sattel, following his festival debut last season, returns with a powerful recital program based on themes of nationalism and revolution. The Austrian composer and conductor Alexander von Zemlinsky lived from 1871 to 1942, and though he was overshadowed by some of the more domineering musical personalities of his era, he nevertheless possessed one of the most emotionally intense compositional languages of his generation. This summer, the Escher Quartet performs Zemlinsky's cycle of four string quartets, a remarkable set of pieces, which surely qualifies among the most unfairly under-recognized contributions to the quartet literature. I spoke recently with Escher Quartet violist Pierre Lapointe, and I started by wondering aloud whether part of the reason these quartets aren't performed more frequently might simply be how difficult they are to play.
Well, that's one reason. They are hard, for sure.
Here's Pierre.
But also it's because of the context where Zemlinsky was. In his lifetime, he was mostly known as a conductor, a little bit like Mahler. You know, both of them were very similar. They actually even dated the same woman, Alma Mahler, you know. Yeah. Zemlinsky dated her before Mahler did, but he never quite made it because he always yearned to get a position in Germany, but he had to move to Prague. You know, that's where he spent most of his career. And then after that, he moved to Berlin in the 30s and worked maybe for a few years in Vienna. But then after that, he moved to the United States, died in the U.S. like Bartok did a little bit later. Bartok died in 45. I think he died in 42 in New York. But the thing is, if you compare Zemlinsky to other composers, he doesn't really fit because he's kind of in between, because he taught Schoenberg, and Schoenberg is the one who started the Second Viennese School, the 12-tone way of composing music, but he never embraced that. Zemlinsky never embraced that, even though he taught Schoenberg. And he's kind of in between Brahms and Schoenberg, and during his lifetime, maybe people considered that his style wasn't avant-garde enough. So that's probably one reason also why he kind of got forgotten. But also, you're right, the pieces are extremely challenging in their own way.
Yeah. Zemlinsky's four quartets spanned 40 years and essentially served to demarcate different periods of his artistic life.
Well, the first one date when he was he just finished studying. He had, I think, a lesson with Brahms, and that's probably a little bit before Brahms died, around, I can't remember exactly, but around 1896, 97, like that time. And it's really funny because Zemlinsky went to Brahms' apartment, and Brahms really believed in him. And that's why Zemlinsky went there. But then I think Brahms studied string quintet that Zemlinsky had written. And as the lesson progressed, Brahms was more and more vehement, a little bit more mean. Why did you wrote this? And then he was trying to explain him why it was not the best choice. And Zemlinsky felt a little bit bad by the end of the encounter. But then Brahms said, oh, I could help you with money, you know, like, because he realized that Zemlinsky had to teach the piano to earn a living. But then he said, I'll give you some money so you can focus on composition, because Brahms, I think, really, and also I think at that time Zemlinsky had written a clarinet trio like Brahms, and then Brahms liked it so much that he recommended that piece to Simrock, his editor. So the first string quartet of Zemlinsky's is really from that period, classical, romantic. Brahms is like that. I would classify him like that. And it's very much like that. And it sounds a little bit like Schumann as well. It's so different from all the three other quartets, but it's definitely, I would say, like a late Brahms. That's how it sounds. And he wrote that right after he was done studying. And the second quartet, that's so different. It's a monumental piece. It's almost like the master trying to emulate the student. Because Schoenberg, obviously, they were very close friends and learned a lot about music from Zemlinsky. But the thing is, Schoenberg was not as gifted as a performer or as a conductor. So he solely devoted himself to composition. And actually also even married Zemlinsky's sister.
In case you missed that biographical detail, Arnold Schoenberg, Zemlinsky's student, wound up marrying Zemlinsky's sister, Mathilde.
He wrote, I think, in the towards the second part of the first decade of the 20th century, his first string quartet, which is like four movements within one. And it's a very complex piece. It's almost like you have four movements of a string quartet, but there's no stop. I'm sure Zemlinsky was really impressed by that, because Zemlinsky, at that point, had only attempted to write one quartet. That was like 12 years ago, and things in music were evolving so quickly that a lot of people would ask Zemlinsky, could we present one of your quartet? And he felt a bit bad in relationship with to the first one, because it was completely out of fashion at that point. So he decided to write something, but also at that point, Zemlinsky's sister had an affair with a painter, Richard Gersel. And Zemlinsky, even though he was not very beautiful, as you might say, he was very successful with women, and he was really promiscuous. But Schoenberg was not. So someone might think that Zemlinsky himself was probably on the side of his sister. She had an affair with someone else. What a big deal. But Schoenberg didn't see it that way at all. So they started to diverge personally at first because of events like that. But afterwards, they diverge musically, you know, because they were very close. But after that, it's like the expansion of universe in some way, like two galaxies going further and further. That's pretty much what happened with two of them. But then Zemlinsky nonetheless tried to apologize to Schoenberg. He decided to write a quartet, because sometimes it's omitted from the first page of the score, but the second string quartet was dedicated to Schoenberg. And it's when he was in Prague, he started writing it, I think, around 1913, 1914, and he decided to have four movements within one big piece, like Schoenberg. But you could also say that because it's nonstop, it's like it's programmatic music in some way. Because Schoenberg, later on in his life, was teaching at the UCLA, I think. And he was trying to explain the intricacies of the first string quartet to his students.
I'll interrupt here just briefly to make sure we're all following. Pierre's talking about Schoenberg later in his life discussing Schoenberg's first string quartet. The piece on which Pierre is suggesting Zemlinsky modeled his own second string quartet.
And at one point, he kind of said something that he was following a program.
In other words, Schoenberg let it slip in front of his students that he had a program in mind, or an extra musical narrative, when writing his first quartet. In much the same way that his famous string sextet for Clairtenacht had been based on a poem in which a woman confesses to her lover that she's carrying a child by another man. But there was no such known program to the first quartet.
So one of the students asked, but which program? We always thought it was absolute music, you know? But then he said, well, it's based on my life, but it's private, so I won't talk about this. But I was in Vienna recently, and I went to the Schoenberg Institute or something, and I've seen him. He has notes for the first quartet. Like, it really describe his story. It's pretty much like him distancing himself from Zemlinsky's sister. When he wrote Verklärungsnacht, he was like madly in love with her, but that didn't last for so long. And then somehow he was distancing. He didn't love her as much. So that's pretty much that story, or like, obviously I'm simplifying it.
So back to Zemlinsky's second quartet.
What I think about that second string quartet, to me, that's what I'm thinking. Because even though people thought for a long time that Schoenberg's first string quartet was pure absolute music, Schoenberg said in the classroom that actually he had a story in mind when he wrote the piece. And I really believe that it's the same for Zemlinsky's second string quartet. He probably had some sort of story. What I'm thinking, all throughout the piece, the cello to me represents Schoenberg. Because, you know, the first time they met, Schoenberg was playing the cello. And if you think of Verklärungsnacht, it's a little bit the same thing. You know, when you have that part in the middle where the right after the woman said, you know, like, I have a child, but it's not yours. But then the man says, I forgive you. It's pretty much like that glorious da 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 da. To me, that's embodying like Schoenberg. And I think Zemlinsky does the same thing in the second quartet.
Assigning the cello to Schoenberg.
Exactly. If you think of a story, and I think the viola represents Mathilde, which was exactly the same in the Verklärungsnacht. Like, whenever like the woman says something, the first viola plays something. And then like, you have like Zemlinsky portrayed by the first violinist. Because Zemlinsky got a trick from Schumann, Bach, and Brahms, you know, like those guys, they used to use letters, you know, like let's say A refers to the note A, and let's say like they could use like Bach, B-A-C-H, you know, you would attribute a letter to a note, and then you would come up with a theme. Zemlinsky, because he has a Z, like, well, he couldn't really do that, but he invented a leitmotif that refers to himself, is like ta-di-di, like D-E-G, and he does that in the beginning of the fourth string quartet as well. That's the first that the first violin play. So also that's how the second quartet starts. And also that motif comes back at the end of the third string quartet, but modulated. Ta-da-di, ta-da-dum, ta-da-dum, ta-da-dum. It comes back all the time. He's using that to say, that's me. Like, so what I'm thinking about that second string quartet, there's definitely a story, because the structure, if you analyze it from a structural point of view, it's very complex. I mean, there's like two sonata forms going at different rates, and like there's a lot of stuff. It's very complex. But you also can then see it from another perspective, where there's a story, you know, like, because if you look at that, Mathilde's always in sync. The viola is always in sync with the first violin, but you rarely see the first violinist in sync with the cello. It happens only at one point in the second movement, the slow movement of that. And the cello actually plays in unison, but he's adding, is a really top register, and it's in a section where it's so like turbulent. It's almost like they're arguing with each other. That quartet to me is almost like at the end when you have like the second violin, because the second violin, I don't attribute that instrument to any character, but I think it's embodying the idea of reconciliation. Ta-da-da, it keeps going to heaven. Like, I think that's really what he was trying to do. Like he's showcasing that dispute in the second movement between Mathilde and Schoenberg. After that, like the viola that starts the third movement. Possibly, like, because Mathilde went away at one point, like, it's, you know, I'm making up a story. Like, I'm sure, like, in some ways, like, Zemlinsky had a story in mind. If you look at those little details, maybe one day we'll find out a document that will, like, tell it that I would be, like, I would not be so surprised. ¶¶ The third string quartet, it's actually a requiem for his sister that had died. Because even though she had an affair with Richard Gersel, the painter actually introduced Schoenberg to painting. After that, she came back because Webern, I think, convinced her to come back because they had kids together, so at least come back for the children. She did. But after that, she was never the same woman. She barely spoke. She was sometimes referred as a silent woman. And she even said, Richard Gersel took the easiest way because he killed himself. But she did not. But her life after that was never the same. And I think Zemlinsky wrote that third string quartet in this around 1923, something like that. But he started it after receiving a postcard from Schoenberg saying that Schoenberg had remarried. But he was really offended by that because by Viennese or Austrian rules back then, when you were a man or a woman, you lost, your husband and your wife, you were supposed usually to respect 1 year of not trying to remarry or anything. But Schoenberg did not do that. And to add more stuff, Schoenberg had always said, when, Mathilde will die, I'll write her something like a requiem, whatever. But he didn't do that. And Zemlinsky was a little bit offended. And the day he received that postcard, he started writing the third string quartet. And I think he decided that's going to be the requiem that Schoenberg will never write, and I will write it for my sister. And then it's funny because that quartet almost mock at times the 12-tone system of Schoenberg. It's as close as Zemlinsky ever was to write 12-tone, but it's definitely not that. And but it's the shortest as well after the second one. It's almost neoclassical also in a. That piece is great because you have a theme and variation that's very well written, the second movement. And it seems to me that Zemlinsky would always write a quartet for some reason. Like the first one was after he was really influenced by Brahms, and then the second one was for Schoenberg because he wanted to apologize to him. And then the third one was for his sister. And the fourth one, I think, was an homage to Alban Berg because Alban Berg died abruptly from a mosquito bite that got infected, I think, in 1935 or something like that. And Zemlinsky and Berg were very close at that point. Berg even wanted to write a book on Zemlinsky because he was really admiring Zemlinsky. He said, I got to write a monograph. And he was planning to do it, but he just died. So that never happened. That's also why maybe Alban Berg dedicated the lyric suite to Zemlinsky.
Alban Berg composed his lyric suite for string quartet in 1926.
And I think Zemlinsky wanted to pay homage to Alban Berg because if you look at the form of the fourth quartet, there's six movements, exactly like the lyric suite, which is unusual for a string quartet usually. And, at the end, you have a treat of writing, of contrapuntal writing, because he even writes a double fugue. Then it's really, really effective. And again, the end is very similar in its virtuosity to the end of the third quartet between all the four voices. But the fourth quartet, it's a little bit more, how should I put it, a little bit more somber than all the other ones. But at times it even sounds like there's passages, even in the second movement, that even sounds like Debussy. They're very different. To sum it up, like those four quartets, Zemlinsky never really entered into like a mold and always repeated himself. Like they're so different. And not, maybe it comes from the fact that he always had someone in mind when he would write the quartets. Since a lot of people don't know Zemlinsky, I want to mention maybe the piece that made him famous, the Lyric Symphony. That piece features two singers, and I think he wrote that in 1927, so he was a very mature conductor, and also based on an Indian poetry, something like that. And that music is so, to me, like I heard it when the New York Philharmonic played it here, like 2-3 years ago. I thought I never had such an experience from the very beginning, because he's so meticulous as a composer. He never repeats himself, always changes. You got that from Brahms, called the developing variation. It's like you're trying to conceive music as organically as you can. You never repeat something exactly the same. You always like tweak it a little bit. And he's an excellent proponent of that. And whatever he writes, he wrote like many operas. You even at one point criticized Richard Strauss, even though you liked Strauss very much, because at one point, I think in Don Quixote, there's a scene with the sheep and all, like, and he says like whatever he created with the effect in terms of like the notes, the music, he says like he should have used even at that point like elements of his theme from before to make it work. He was criticizing; he was not deep enough. Like Zemlinsky, always to me, like if you analyze it, because I analyze a few of mostly the quartets, but like every note can be explained. Like for instance, in the second string quartet, like the very beginning, the first few bars, in that you have the form pretty much. You can extract the rest of the material. Because for instance, in the second movement, the third movement of that piece, like he always starts in D and then he modulates to E flat and he goes back to D. That's always the curve of those, tonally of those movements. And if you think of the beginning, it says ta-da-da, ta-da, ta-da-da, ta-da, the E flat's right there. So there's so much depth in that writing. And I feel he had a great musical sense in general. Even Stravinsky said, like after hearing him conducting, I think in Prague, I forgot which opera, but the Mozart opera, Stravinsky, possibly the greatest composer of the 20th century, said that was one of the greatest musical experiences of my life. And he attributes that to Zemlinsky's conducting. So I think maybe the reason why his music is not well known, I mean, I know there's guys like James Conlon that are trying to put his music to the forefront, but I think it's just a matter of time. Even Schoenberg said that. He said, Zemlinsky, eventually, time will come for him.